Hello and welcome to the Potential Psychology Podcast. I'm your host, Ellen Jackson, and it's my mission to share the science of human behaviour in a practical, fun and inspiring way. In each podcast episode, I interview an expert from the fields of psychology, well-being, leadership, parenting or high performance. I pick their brain to uncover what they know about living well, what tips do they have for you and I, and I quiz them about how they apply their expertise in their own life. Join me as we discover simple, science-backed ways to live, learn, flourish, and fulfill your potential. Welcome to the Potential Psychology Podcast, or welcome back if you're a long-time listener. If you're a first-time listener, welcome. I'm pleased to have you here. I'm pleased to have everyone here. I love sharing my guests, sometimes my insights. I'll go into that in a moment. And just this time with you, this is episode 28. I'm very excited to bring you today's discussion. There is, as there always is, something that I learned this week, and it does relate to my podcast interview and the discussion I'm having with my guest today. And it's really how difficult it is to talk about topics relating to gender without slipping into gender stereotypes and generalizations. It's something that my guest today and I both frequently found ourselves saying, things like, I don't want to generalize too much, but, and I know this is a stereotype, but, and it is really difficult. And I struggle with this because I really do value individualism above the other categories that we use. I live in a world, I like to think, certainly in my world, in my head, where we place common humanity and the fact that we are all human first. We perhaps then, or certainly I do, like to place individualism and the fact that we are all unique second. And then the other categories that we use to describe people, gender, race, religion, whatever it might be, much further down the list. And yet, I also acknowledge that human beings need ways to make meaning and make sense and be able to reduce the enormous amount of input, all the data that comes into our brains in every moment. And we need to be able to reduce that down to simpler things in order to make decisions and just make sense of that data. And hence, things like gender are really important for that. And it's a whole other, I think, topic of conversation. It's not something that we go into today. And that is just acknowledging the complexity of being able to see people as individuals whilst also talking about differences, because there are statistically significant differences across a number of different domains. If we kind of put those people who identify as female in one group and those people who identify as male in another, you know, we do differ on those dimensions. And of course, there are those people who don't necessarily identify as either. So this is complex stuff, or maybe I'm just making it more complex than it needs to be. I don't know. What do you think? Let me know. It's certainly not something that needs to be that complicated for the purpose of today's podcast discussion. So let me introduce my guest and we'll take it from there. My guest today, while still in the relatively early days of his career as a registered psychologist, has carved out a niche for himself and his practice in what has been a traditionally very underserviced area. Carl Nelms is the director and founder of Bloke Psychology, which might give you a hint as to his niche, and based in Melbourne here in Australia. And Carl's background is in community health counselling and mental health outreach support. He's worked with ex-offenders reintegrating into society. He's worked with various national helplines, and he has experience and a specific interest in supporting individuals with anger and addictions. Carl's also worked extensively with asylum seekers, newly arrived migrants and refugees, both on and offshore. But today he's here to talk to us about Bloke Psychology. Welcome, Carl.
Thank you. Thank you. Pleasure to be here, Helen.
It's lovely to have you. And can I start by asking, because we have a lovely, diverse international audience here on the Potential Psychology Podcast. So not everybody might be familiar with the term bloke. What does bloke mean?
Not a question I've been asked before. Bloke, I suppose it's bloke is an Australian term for male or man or boy, I suppose, young bloke, old bloke. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and I did Google this myself because I didn't know. I assumed that it was perhaps an Australian term, but apparently, according to Wikipedia, the source of all interesting things, it's a term that's used, or slang term that's used in not only Australia, but also the UK, New Zealand, and South Africa.
South Africa, yeah.
Yeah. So, but of course, in Australia, we know the term bloke as being a term for man, male, yeah, as you say, boy, young bloke, old bloke. And I love that it's the name of your psychology practice. What led you into this field? Who are you servicing as a psychologist?
What led me into the field? I suppose it's a long story, so I'll keep it short. Probably 18, 24 months ago, I was working in the community health centre for Gamblers Help, predominantly working with males, but because I was the youngest clinician there, I was getting a lot of the young males as well. And through supervision, I started to realise the way I engage with my male clientele, not always, but usually was very, very different to the way I had to engage with my female clientele. And through supervision, peer supervision, I got talking about this aspect and actually said to a client once, I often asked them, what made you come to the service or what made you reach out for help? And this one chap, he said, oh, I've been wanting to do it for 5 or 10 years. And I said to him, okay, so why now? And basically said, well, where would I have gone beforehand? You know, I'm only here because, you know, shit hit the fan, so to speak, at home with his gambling and the other issues going on. But he said, I'd had referrals in the past, but where would I go? He actually said himself, he felt like a man going into a woman's world, going into therapy. And I was potentially naive at the time. And I thought, okay, this is interesting. There's a lot of psychology clinics around, but well, what's missing? And then I started doing a lot of research on local clinics in interstates all over the world, actually, and probably 90 to 95% of them, especially locally, tailored more towards females. I don't like to generalize, but generally they're more focused around the wellness, the mindfulness, the emotion focus, talking about the cognitive behavioral therapy, all the different therapies. But even for me as a man who studied psychology, that doesn't really invite you. That doesn't make you feel like that's a space for you. So I was speaking one day in supervision with my clinical supervisor, and I was talking about this issue, and she was saying, okay, so what do you think needs to happen? And I said, I was joking, there was no genuine intentions. I basically said to her, oh, it's almost like there needs to be a bloke psychology clinic or something. And I sort of laughed, and she just looked me dead in the eye and said, do it. And yeah, the rest is history.
And you did it.
I did it. I gave it a shot, and yeah, it's been amazing actually how receptive people have been and how far people are willing to travel just because they feel as though it's a service that resonates with them and it's a place for blokes and men of all ages.
Which is, and this intrigues me because, I mean, it makes perfect sense in so many ways. And I think perhaps the fact that psychology is maybe perceived more frequently as a female-oriented thing, you know, the services are female oriented. And we know, you know, I mean, you and I have both been through psychology degrees. It is predominantly females in the universities, in the courses. And yet when it comes to, I suppose for me, it's looking at it from the point of view of, you know, we all have these biases, don't we? So I kind of look at it and say, okay, you know, this is what psychology is, the mindfulness and a lot of the topics that we talk about here. But even as you were saying that, I thought, oh, so I am inadvertently targeting perhaps more of a female audience than a male audience just by nature of some of the topics that we choose, the way that we frame things up, perhaps the language that we use, that these are more maybe stereotypically female versus male.
I think that's a really good point because one of the trainings that I rave about when I speak to people about this is the no bullshit therapy training that the Bouverie Center runs. And that whole training is basically, without getting too in the clinical jargon, is basically what we learn in psychology training is great, but 90% of the time it's for therapy lovers. And very few men are therapy lovers. Very few men know what therapy or counseling is. So I think whilst what I do is probably no different to what a lot of clinicians do, it's about how you market it, how you sell that, but also tailoring that to communicate that to men in a different way.
Yeah, yeah, a branding type element, I suppose. And is it that, so maybe it's not, even so much along gender lines. Maybe it is more something to do with an openness to some of the concepts or some of the, you know, the willingness to speak. I know we talk stereotypically about, you know, women being more open to talking about their feelings versus men. Now, I know, having spoken to Madeline Fernbach, I did a podcast interview with her on transgender, and she was very keen on identifying that these are perhaps the stereotypes that we all hold, that women are like this and men are like that. You know, I think probably to some extent there are, you know, stereotypes arise for a reason. I don't know what you think, but, you know, I like the idea of this being kind of, you know, psychology for therapy lovers versus psychology for perhaps the therapy resistant or the therapy agnostic.
Yeah, I like that, the agnostics.
That's a different way of thinking about it. Okay, so who are your clientele? They're men and they're blokes. Why do they come to see you? Because you say they're coming from far and wide.
Look, I'd love to say that they're just they've noticed something isn't right. They've been proactive in the early stages, but the reality is 90% probably. Their parents brought them there, their wife's encouraging them. You know, something's gone wrong. Things are getting to the point where the partner's going to leave, they're feeling suicidal, they're going to lose their job, the substance use is out of control. That's usually the catalyst, unfortunately. But I would say within that, actually, it's surprising the younger generation are actually a lot better at being much more proactive.
Okay, that's interesting. That was something I was going to ask you a little further down the track, but maybe we'll talk about it now. So perhaps for many people, it's about reaching crisis point or being aware that crisis point is imminent unless action is taken.
Correct, yeah.
But not necessarily. And the reason I find that interesting is I've spoken to a couple of workplaces and we've been talking about things like mental health and well-being and how to identify signs and symptoms of mental ill health and how to help people. And I have had a couple of men perhaps in their 40s or 50s reflect to me that these have been topics that have been difficult for them. And I don't think it is entirely just gender specific. I think it's equally difficult for a lot of women. But what they've noticed is that their sons, so young men perhaps in their late teens or early 20s, seem to be far more comfortable with the discussions, the concepts. And one guy I remember not that long ago told me that, or told the group that, he had a son who I think was back in his early 20s and he was supposed to be studying for university exams. And dad said, you know, you're going out, why aren't you studying, you know, doing the dad thing. And he said, oh, look, my mate so-and-so, who he knew had a history of difficulty in relation to his mental health, who struggled at times, he really needs someone right now. And so we're going out to dinner. And his dad, you know, hard to be cross then. Just, well, okay, you should be studying, but by the same token, wow, you've identified, you know, that this is someone who struggles, who knows that just connection with another human being is helpful and that's the path you're taking, and good on you for that. So that kind of opened my mind up to the idea that maybe things are changing.
I think they're definitely changing. I'm turning 30 in a week, so I feel quite old, but I'm aware I'm still quite young. You know, it wasn't that long ago. I was in high school. And I think that's one of the benefits that I can really connect to with these teenagers. But I nearly fall off the chair sometimes. You know, a teenager came in last week. He was 16, 17. He'd asked his dad to make an appointment. He came in. His dad didn't know why he was coming. And now this definitely isn't all teenage boys, but he sat down and I said to him, okay, so what brings you here? And he said, look, I've just been going through a lot of changes lately. I've just got a girlfriend. I've started experimenting with ABC. There's a lot of big emotions that I need to work through.
Wow.
And I mean, even when I was at high school 15 years ago, we didn't know the terminology. We knew there was depression and anxiety, but we didn't know what that was and how to support people. But now I think they're leading the way. A lot of dads I see said, you know, my teenage son and daughter, they're teaching us about mental health, mindfulness, and self-care. So that's incredible. The initiatives going on in schools at the moment is truly incredible.
And is that where it sits? Is it within schools that these discussions are starting to be had, or is it elsewhere?
I think primarily it is the schools. Primarily it starts in the schools and then it promotes that discussion at home and in other areas. But whether it be public schools or private schools, I've got a lot of teenagers who say, yeah, we do Mindfulness Monday before school, or you know, we go on a mental health retreat once a year to talk about our self-care throughout VCE and those sort of things. I mean, they just weren't even thought about even 5-10 years ago.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? I often say that in workplaces as well, that, you know, from my experience of having worked in workplaces for the better part of 20 years or maybe more now, I'm now often talking about self-care, resilience, well-being, mental health. 10 years ago, nothing, you know, just it wasn't a thing. So our institutions, which I think is exciting as somebody who's keen to see our institution playing a role in mental health and wellbeing, it sounds like, you know, certainly workplaces, I'm doing some stuff, but it sounds like schools are starting to get this stuff really right as well, if it's getting to the point where the kids have the language and are both self-identifying and then taking that next step of coming to see someone like yourself.
Oh, definitely, definitely. I think it'll be very interesting in the next 10, 15 years when this generation enters the workplace, because they're going to have expectations on workplaces that's going to completely change the culture for the better, I think.
Yeah. So I'm very positive, optimistic. I'm excited to hear that you've got these young people. What about the others? What about the perhaps the older men or those people for whom this is about reaching crisis point? What are the kind of issues that they're facing?
Oh, I mean, you would know as well as I do, Alan. No two clients are the same, but sure. I suppose to generalize, there's a lot of guys in their early 20s who the primary reason they're coming underneath all the depression, anxiety or addictions is basically searching for direction in life. They might have done 2-3 courses, a few jobs, and, you know, all their friends are finishing courses, getting into the real world of full-time employment. And these guys are realizing, I don't know what I want to do in life. And that's searching for direction. And without direction, it really gets down to their identity as well. Who am I? How do I fit into the world post-high school? So there's those guys. There's a lot of them. A few of them I get are actually really struggling with their gender identity, sexuality as well, which is interesting. I didn't think people struggling with that would come to a place called bloke psychology, but that was just my perception.
That's interesting, isn't it?
That was my perception. I asked them about that and they said, I didn't think about that. So that's interesting.
Maybe it was, you know, just without the kind of bloke being the blokey bloke, it is just, this is a male staffed psychology practice where all males are welcome.
And that's pretty much what they said. So, you know, my perception was very different to theirs. Mm. I suppose the other large cohort, probably 40 to 50% are guys in their 30s, 40s and 50s. The guys in their 30s are usually struggling with fatherhood, whether it's a recent thing or it's coming up, a lot of postnatal issues, feeling really incompetent as dads, trying to find themselves as dads and still have a life for themselves. But the other large bulk would be sort of the guys in their 40s and 50s who I label them, I don't like to generalize, but I label them as the sort of guys who they've sort of neglected themselves in the process of providing for their families.
Okay.
So they've lost their identity. They've lost, you know, I often ask them, I say, who are you without your working family? And they don't have an answer because they don't have friends anymore. They don't have hobbies. They don't have much at all, which is really sad.
Yeah. That's really interesting, isn't it? So a lot of these themes will come back to this idea of identity, this who am I? You know, whether it's I think I need to know and I don't, or I've now, say, perhaps lost my job and I never thought to understand or think about who I was without that.
Yeah.
All the way along the spectrum. Interesting that you talk about the postnatal and fatherhood element too, because I did talk recently to Nadine van der Linden about the transition to parenthood, particularly from a mother's perspective. And we were able to talk because we'd both been there. So talk from practical experience as well as our experience and understanding as a psychologist about that. And I think there is, you know, I think even for women, there's a huge emphasis placed on what you are expected to do, what you should do, how you should feel when making a transition to parenthood, but not really that emphasis that I've seen anyway, but maybe I'm just looking in the wrong places about what that means for men, the transition to fatherhood.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And I think you're really correct in saying that it all comes back to identity. I think identity, regardless of what age the client is, it comes back to identity for men and, you know, for women as well. But a lot of the guys who are transitioning to fatherhood, one thing they say is they feel the pressure of, okay, I've got a little person looking up to me now. especially if they're a boy, I don't know how to be a man in this world. How do I teach him? And that the pressure and anxiety that that brings on, you know, it can be a snowball and bring a lot of other issues.
Yeah. And what do you say when someone comes to you with that sort of scenario? Because that's some pretty deep thinking there about who am I, but also who do I want to be as a role model for somebody else?
Yeah.
I know you can't give me specific guidance because it would depend on the individual, but what sort of themes do you look for? What kind of conversation do you have?
I like to start talking to guys about who they were 10 years ago.
Yep.
What did they used to do? What did your week used to look like? And, you know, their eyes will light up. They go, oh, I used to play this, or I used to do this with my mates, and I'd do this, go away here. And so the first thing I always say is, well, okay, how can we draw a thread from who you used to be to who you are now? And then start exploring a lot of the underpinning values within that and go, okay, well, how can you, you know, I'm a big fan of my acceptance commitment therapy. So try to implement with that where I can with the guys and say, okay, well, how can we live by those values now as a dad? But also, I mean, always if guys are coming in talking about fatherhood and that transition to parenthood, talking about their dad, their relationship with their dad. Most of the time it wasn't ideal. Okay, so what would you have liked? And how can you give your child, son or daughter, that experience?
So perhaps the things that they felt they missed out on.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. How fascinating. And what led you to psychology as a profession more broadly? We've discussed the niche, but, you know, why psychology?
I was thinking about this and it was actually last weekend I was at an engagement party thanking the guy who encouraged me to study psychology. He was my best friend's dad. We were 14 at the time, sitting at his kitchen table, choosing our elective for year 9. And he sat us down and said, I don't care what you guys pick, but I want you to pick psychology. And we said, well, why? And he said, I don't care what jobs you get, whether you're a janitor or a CEO. He said, you need to work with people. He said, the more you can understand people, the easier it is to develop a rapport and get on with them. I don't care what profession you do. So that was enough to sell me on it. And I think probably halfway through the year 9 psychology course, I loved it and I was fascinated by it. Didn't necessarily know I wanted to be a psychologist, but I knew that I want to keep studying this and find out what it's all about. Started university doing a double degree in teaching psychology. Got a bit caught up in uni life, failed my teaching first semester. But I love psychology that much that I, despite getting involved in uni life, still managed to pass and kept pursuing with it.
That's testament to finding something that you're passionate about, isn't it? That you can still find a way to make it work even with all those distractions of uni life.
Yeah, I thought it was a sign.
So interesting. I'm very jealous because psychology wasn't a subject at school when I was at school. I'm 15 years older than you and yeah, it didn't exist. So I had to wait until I got to uni before I found out kind of what it was all about. And such insight from your mate's dad to say that, it's funny, isn't it, the way career paths just pan out. But I think that I can relate to that kind of, you know, just fascination, I suppose, in human behavior and what it is and how it works and curiosity surrounding that.
Species, aren't we?
So interesting. But it took a little while to actually get to the point then of becoming a registered psychologist. Is that right?
Yeah, yes.
I mean, it takes everyone a while because it just takes such a long time. But
yes, we could have another podcast about that, I think. So I did my first 4 years, over 5 years, I think. I was just plodding along, making sure I got the grades I needed. But then I took 3 or 4 years off because I wanted to work. I wanted to get in the real world and make sure that if I'm going to commit to masters, that it's something I actually want to do. So I worked in a lot of different roles, counseling, case management in the AOD sector, but also primarily in the refugee space, which that was as challenging as that was professionally an amazing experience, truly amazing. And it confirmed for me that I was on the right path.
Excellent. Wonderful. I know those signs, the signs of confirmation that this is where I'm meant to be and what I'm meant to be doing. Where do you take it from here? I mean, obviously you've established your practice, you've got a clientele. What would you like to see if we're kind of projecting forward now? We've talked a little bit about some changes perhaps in men's approach, younger generation versus an older generation, to understanding mental health and well-being, what would be your vision?
My vision. I've thought about this a bit too, because it's not a question I'd really thought about ever.
Well, I like to ask all the challenging questions.
Yeah. I think I'd love to see us as a society get to the point where we can talk about mental health just as easily as we talk about physical health. So, for example, if one of my friends asked me, hey, Carl, what are you doing for dinner Thursday? And I said, oh, look, I'm busy. I'm going to the physio. I've strained my calf at soccer again. And I say to him, oh, what about Tuesday? And he says, oh, no, mate, look, I'm going to the psych. You know, that anxiety's popped up again. And I say, oh, okay, sorry to hear anybody chat about that. I'm going to see you, but let's catch up Wednesday. I think if we can get to a point where those conversations are as simple as that, then we've taken huge steps in the right direction to erase that stigma and normalize it and just make people feel like it is actually normal to struggle emotionally at times and have mental health concerns.
Hmm. And even I'm wondering for you as a practitioner, and I know you said that this was something, you know, that the younger kids are perhaps are starting to identify around the proactivity piece, you know, not waiting until you are really struggling, but actually identifying that you can go talk to somebody like yourself about things when you're even just in an exploratory phase, maybe.
Yeah. You know, a client said something interesting to me the other day. He was in his 30s, and he was talking to a mate about coming to see me, but he was a bit unsure. And his mate said to him, he said, don't be an idiot. He said, who do you get to do your taxes? And the guy goes, well, my accountant. And he said, well, who did you get to build your fence? He goes, well, the builder or the fencer. And he goes, and you think you're going to be able to sort out your mind by yourself? He goes, don't be an idiot. Go pay a professional. And that's what sold him. That's what sold him on it.
You could relate to that.
Yeah. I thought that was brilliant.
Yeah. And I mean, it makes perfectly logical sense, doesn't it? That's the weird thing about the kind of stigma attached to some of these things that we need in life, is that we get kind of caught up with our ideas about how things should be. But that's just really practical. That's practical advice. You know, go get somebody, we'll talk to somebody who has professional expertise in this area.
Mm-hmm. And you put it in the terms of fixing. I think men say, oh, yes, I will fix that. Perfect.
I will fix that. So the language makes a difference.
Mm.
Mm. I recently read Osher Ginsberg's book Back After the Break, which he describes his struggles with his mental health, starting from quite a young age, and his drinking and his drug use and his various attempts to deal with what was going on in his mind that led to relationship breakdowns and all sorts of things, you know, the kind of perhaps pattern that we might see. And one of the things that he said he came to realize was that he couldn't fix his problems with the same brain that kind of created them.
That's brilliant, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a great way to put it.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, it just described it so nicely for me, this idea that, because we know that, you know, when your brain is kind of messed up and muddled up for whatever reason, trying to unpick that yourself with that same brain is going to be impossible. But I don't think I'd really thought about it in quite those terms until he described it, encapsulated it that way.
Mm. No, it is great.
Yeah. And it's a great book to read too, particularly in your niche, because he does give, I suppose, a male perspective and tells a story that I think might be, you know, with drug use and alcoholism and anger and behaviors that, again, I'm making an assumption as a female looking at men, you know, kind of manifest some of the perhaps underlying problems. And he's able to share that. And I know his passion is in sharing that story, because it was only when he started to hear other men speak about their experiences that he suddenly twigged that he wasn't A, alone in this, and B, there was a way to kind of work your way out of it.
Yeah. Well, I think that's extremely powerful. And I try and encourage all my clients to tell their mates they're coming to see a psychologist, because I say exactly that. I say it might not necessarily be about you sharing that with them, but I guarantee one of them might twig and go, okay, that might give them the strength and permission to reach out.
Yeah. Permission's a big one, isn't it? Allowing ourselves to know that it's okay to do something about it. Hmm. I'm keen to explore this changing over time notion, this idea that our young people perhaps are starting to have a better sense of well-being. What are some of the other things that you've observed amongst young men coming to see you? Because they're not, it's not all going to be proactive, is it?
Oh, no, no, definitely not. But even the ones who come when things are going wrong or at crisis point, as you highlighted before, they have the language, they have the basic understanding, or as we would call it, you know, the psychoeducation about mental health. So that's a great starting point. And they also, a lot of them have the determination to actually, okay, explore what's going on with them and what they can do about it. Because I always tell, whether it be the teenagers or the older guys, I say, you're in the driver's seat here. So I can navigate, I can direct you, but you're in charge of the steering wheel, you're in charge of the brakes, you're in charge of the accelerator. And I think that's really empowering for the young guys, especially because a lot of 16-year-olds come in and their parents are pulling their hair out going, you know, there's significant school refusal, substance abuse, and who knows what else. And a lot of the time I say in the first session to the 16-year-old, I say, look, I can't force you to change. Your parents can't either. But you've got to think really hard about this because in a year or two, you're an adult. And the decisions you make now, they're going to have some pretty significant implications for you. And that's, and just that transparency with them seems to really resonate with them.
Yeah, they get it. They understand.
Mm, yeah. Yeah. I think it. A lot of the teenagers I've seen might have seen had bad experiences for one reason or another with school counselors or whatnot. And, you know, a lot of the first thing I say to teenage boys, I say, I'm going to ask you a few questions today, but you can ask me as many questions as you like. But today, all you're here to do is figure out if it's, I'm worth coming back to have a chat to. So the power and the ball's always in their court.
Yeah. Yeah. And that language, I know you were just using there the description or that kind of analogy of driving the car. So again, you know, something or language that's very practical that, you know, certainly young men would understand and perhaps resonate with. What, and I know this might not be something you've even reflected on necessarily, but what is it, do you think, that works in terms of your style versus perhaps, you know, they've gone to see a school counsellor who's most likely female? You know, what is it that you think really kind of makes the difference?
Look, I think firstly it helps that I'm a male with a teenage boy, especially a younger male. So I've already got that benefit. Yep. But I suppose if you were to view an initial session with me and a teenager, it's not particularly clinical at all. It's more like a casual chat. And being able to talk their language as well. If we're talking about drugs and as soon as I start using some of the terminology or lingo, you can tell they look at you and go, ah, okay, this guy knows. And I tell them, I say, you can't bullshit me. So if you think I'm bullshitting you, tell me. But I said, I know what you're talking about. So being able to speak their language again, I think really helps them feel comfortable.
And pretty plain and straightforward language from the sounds of things.
Oh, definitely. Definitely.
And so I'm thinking from a parent's perspective. So I have two boys myself who are still primary school age. We haven't got to any of the kind of really tricky situations yet. But if you were to guide or advise particularly the parents of boys about creating healthy young men, what are the sorts of tips or strategies you might suggest?
Healthy young men.
Hmm.
I always say to parents whenever I see them, and I'm seeing one of their teenagers, I say, don't be afraid to nag the crap out of your son.
Okay, that's interesting.
And the teenagers hate when I say that, but I say, the thing about a nagging parent is you never have to question if they care about you or love you or are thinking about you, ever. And I said, in 5 or 10 years, you're going to look back and go, you know, mum was always on my back, but I knew that she always cared about me, was thinking about me. I suppose the hardest thing for parents is to differentiate between normal teenage isolation and mood swings and teenage behavior and something to actually concern yourself with. That's the real difficult thing, I think, because I get a lot of parents bring teenagers in and, to be honest, there's not a lot going on. They probably don't need to be there, but the parents just don't have that dialogue to actually assess that.
So okay.
Trying to open that dialogue, 90% of the time they're not going to want a bar of it, but as long as you keep trying, when and if they need to open that dialogue and reach out for support or have a chat, they know that they can. they know that that's there.
So what are the sorts of things parents should be, you know, how do you open that dialogue, I suppose? Because that is, as a parent, you don't, and again, my kids are still little, so it's not quite an issue, but I can sort of anticipate a day parenting teenagers where you don't want to become that totally annoying, roll your eyes at them parent.
Yeah.
All the time. Although I take your point that at least if you are nagging, you're indicating that you're caring. How do you kind of walk that line and open that dialogue with kids so that you do tap into perhaps where things are not working well?
I think for sons, especially teenage sons, I'm a big fan of Steve Bidoff, who I'm sure you've heard of, Australian psychologist and guru in boys, I suppose. And he talks a lot about in the teenage years, Dad is very important, but so are other male role models in that child's life. So if you were concerned about a teenage boy, of course, hopefully there's dad or a father figure of some shape or form there to try and have some discussions about not only the teenager's well-being, but also the dad's well-being. I try and encourage dads, you know, if you want your teenage boy to speak to you about this, you need to self-disclose and say, you know, I've struggled with ABC. But also if I acknowledge a lot of families these days don't have that. And that's where you need to rely on uncles, brother-in-laws, soccer coaches, footy coaches, teachers, and those sort of things. Because for teenage boys especially, and Steve Bidoff talks about this a lot, that those male role models are really essential because they're the formative years of how the teenager forms his idea and identity of what it means to be a man in our society.
So as a parent, really looking, I suppose, then at who are the other men in that child's life that can have an influence, that can perhaps be someone that they can connect with, or even who is just modelling the sort of stuff that you want your son to be, you know, sort of look at, you know, who are the footy coaches or the soccer coaches or the basketball coaches, you know, are they the kind of men that you want your child to be?
Exactly. What sort of values are they going to instill in your son?
Yeah. Okay. Interesting. So what else, you know, that, so role modeling plays a part, and I'll put references in the show notes to Steve Bidoff's work. Cause I know even for me, as a psychologist, when I first had my elder son and then I went on to have another son, I thought, God, I know nothing about boys. You know, I've only ever been a girl. I grew up with a sister. I grew up in a very female dominated family. Thankfully, my husband has three brothers. So he kind of got, and I would often defer to them, especially when they were little and they're kind of rolling around and beating each other up and just this physicality that I wasn't used to. And I'd often say, is this normal? Like, is this? And you go, yeah, that's just what boys do. But Steve Bidoff's books, that Raising Boys, was very helpful to me to kind of understand this, you know, slightly different perspective on how one gender might work compared to the other. So role models are important, having people that they can talk to, trying to open the dialogue, and perhaps that is dialogue with another man rather than with mum where possible, if that's going to help. What else should parents be doing to raise healthy young men?
I think boundaries. Boundaries are really, really important. A lot of the time I'm seeing clients, teenage boys, and it's not the parents' fault, but a lot of the times they've almost given up. And the 14, 15-year-old sort of living his life like he's 19 or 20. And the boundaries, again, are so important to set that precedent early or try and implement them when you identify that, wow, we haven't had any boundaries and talking to them about that. They're not always going to stick to those boundaries. But again, it's about what those boundaries communicate to that kid. And, you know, I have a lot of teenage boys who actually say, I don't actually think my parents care about me. And I said, well, why is that? They go, well, you know, if I storm out in a huff, you know, and stay out the night, they wouldn't even call or worry or whatever.
They just let me go.
Exactly. And as much as that teenager would probably hate it if the parents went after them, again, it communicates that, you know what, you're cared about, you're supported, we love you, and we're here for you.
Yeah. And I think that is an interesting way to think about it, because I think I can imagine, and again, haven't quite got there yet, but I can imagine that letting your teenage boy, and, you know, for me and for as a woman, you know, one day my kids are going to be bigger and stronger than me. They will shout louder than me. Their physical presence will be overpowering to me. So having a teenage boy, particularly perhaps if he's young, but he's also big and strong, storm out, just that physicality, which again, you know, maybe that's a woman's issue of knowing that there's always other people who can physically overpower you pretty easily, potentially even your own children, storming out. And then, you know, do I go after them? Well, if I do, what am I going to do? What can I say? Do I have much power there? So that might be the kind of thing that's going through a parent's mind. Mm-hmm. But you're saying you do it because you need to demonstrate, that is demonstrating that you're caring, even if there's nothing you can actually do about it in that moment. You're at least kind of sending a message.
Well, doing something, I think, not just giving up and going, oh, well, what can we do anyway? Because a lot of parents say that, you know, well, I can't stop him. But it doesn't mean you don't try.
Yeah. Okay. I think that's wonderful advice. And when we talk about boundaries, what are some of the boundaries that we should be setting?
That's a really, really hard question. I suppose it comes back to expectations. Accepting that a lot of teenage boys, statistics show now, are going to experiment with alcohol and probably a few other substances at a very, very alarming young age, actually. And having, again, getting back to having that dialogue, but also communicating what your expectations are as a parent and as a family about substances. Now, that's for the individual family to decide, but I suppose the teenage boy needs to know in different realms, whether it be substances, staying out late, schoolwork, all of those, what the expectations are of the family.
Okay. So family expectations, family rules. It's interesting because we're actually talking, I ran a workshop this morning with a client organization. We're talking about values and we're talking about organizational values, but we started with personal values, you know, to understand the concept and what are our personal values. And I talked about the family as being kind of that intermediary step, that thing, you know, what are our values as a family? And one of the individuals in the workshop said that, you know, well, respect is a really important one for us, the way we interact with each other, the way we treat each other, the way we speak to each other. And I said, yeah, I can relate to that, you know, that we have these kind of, and I suppose that's what these expectations are, you know, we set some boundaries, some rules, we have values that say, this is how we do things in our family. And that won't necessarily be the same. And I know that, you know, because I already get it from my kids. Well, so-and-so's mum doesn't, you know, expect this, or so-and-so's allowed to play Fortnite till midnight or whatever. It's like, but that's not what we do in our house, which is always my comeback, at which point they roll their eyes at me.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And don't get started on Fortnite though.
Oh, yeah. That is, again, another whole conversation. Okay, so we've got role models, we've got boundaries, we've got nagging and showing that we care through nagging. What else should parents be doing to help their sons?
To help. I mean, I know I keep harping on this, but it's really, especially with teenage boys, as hard as it is, doing things with them.
Yeah.
As simple as taking footy training, watching football matches, things like that. As a parent, whether it's a mum, dad, stepdad, whatever it is, it might seem boring and monotonous, but kids remember that, and that means a lot, especially when it comes to sport or performances. All kids, especially in their teenage years, they know when the parents there or not there, and they look around and they know if, you know, their friends' parents are there, but their parents aren't there. Okay. So supporting them, but just doing things with them if they're interested. Even if they are interested in Fortnite, play Fortnite with them. Get to know Fortnite and speak that lingo.
Yeah. So being involved.
Yeah.
Yeah. And again, you know, thinking about it as a parent, you kind of perhaps assume that at some point they want their independence. They don't want their parents necessarily involved, but you're saying that even if outwardly they don't show that or they're not asking for it, inwardly it's still important.
Oh, definitely. I mean, I don't think you'd ever had a teenage boy say, oh, Dad, thanks for coming to all my footy games this year. I really appreciate it. No. But in 10, 20 years, he'll remember it and he might thank you for it.
Okay. So, that's interesting. And I think maybe that is around what is outwardly communicated isn't necessarily what's inwardly felt. So just because somebody isn't asking for it, saying it, doesn't mean it's not important, and making an assumption that if they're not asking for it, it's because they don't want it isn't necessarily the right assumption in terms of helping them to be their best.
Exactly. There's a lot more going on beyond the surface below a teenager's I don't know.
That is interesting, because I think perhaps, again, and this might be stereotypical, but you know, a woman's need to perhaps talk or ask questions, or there's that, again, stereotype of wanting to just let's talk about it and talk. And if that's not what particularly a teenage boy is, you know, comes naturally or is really wanting to do, there could, I can imagine, be a sort of a disconnect there.
Definitely.
You know, mum tries to engage them in a conversation and they've just, it's, don't know, or the grunt or not actually doing the talking part. Mum walks away saying, well, I can't talk to him. He doesn't want to talk, or he doesn't want to talk to me, and just sort of leaves it. But yeah.
Don't give up though. Don't give up. Show that you care.
Okay. Excellent. And what can men do for each other?
To support each other, I suppose, in mental health and their well-being. It sounds really cliche, but of course there's talk, you know, there's a lot of advocacy campaigns and awareness about talking, checking in with each other. But I think before that, one thing men and most men really can be crap at is maintaining friendships. And it's all well and good to tell males of all ages to talk. Friendships for men in their adolescence, early 20s, not always, but oftentimes are a lot easier. You have hobbies, you have sporting groups, you have university, TAFE, workplaces. But something happens when you get to your early to mid to late 20s that drops off. The events drop off and men find themselves realizing, I have to make an effort now. And a lot of them just don't.
Mm.
The most important thing for men, I mean, you need to maintain your friendships. You need to create time to see friends, figure out who are the two or three friends that I really value and want in my life, and really foster that. Because if you don't do that, when it comes time to having those discussions about, hey, I'm not okay, if you don't have a friendship that's recent or a friendship that's built on that foundation of regular contact, you've got no foundation to have that discussion.
Yeah. So that connectedness is so important.
Hmm. Well, I mean, they talk a lot about loneliness at the moment is a huge, huge issue, and they predict it's going to be an epidemic. And you can see why, because so many men, whether they're my clients or there's men I know in my personal life, you start talking about their friendships and they go, oh, I've got one or two friends that I see once every 6 months or so. That's not a friendship. That's an old friend that you're catching up with, but that's not a friendship. That's not an active friendship. Mm. So it's creating time for that. But it's also, if you know a male in your life, whether it's your brother, your husband, or whoever it is, it's about encouraging them, giving them permission again to actually create time for that. Because the more connected they are, the better the male self-care is, the better husband, the better father, the better person they're going to be for the family.
Mm. And you think this is something that shifted with the generation, or perhaps has been set up by previous generations? You know, I think about my dad and his cohort, you know, his men of his age group, that as largely the primary breadwinner for a family. And perhaps in a society that kind of modelled men were there to work and earn the money and do bits and pieces for the family, but that wasn't their primary focus, that's where those disconnect from, you know, if your head's down, bums up, working the whole time, there isn't that space for connectedness either within the family necessarily, and certainly not when it comes to extension to friendships.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head there. I think over the last few generations, more and more has been expected of men in terms of the family realm, but they're still placing the same amount of pressure on themselves as the provider, and it's leaving little time for anything else at all. Mm. And a lot of men say, I feel guilty for having to hit a golf once a fortnight. But again, if they did that, there would be much better fathers, much better parents.
Mm. That self-care piece. And it's so interesting that you say that, because I hear so many, you know, there's so many women, and I know I've said this myself, that once upon a time women only had to do the family. Now the expectation is that we do the family, but we also have careers. Mm. And we kind of assume that that's a woman-only issue, but clearly it's not when you phrase it like that. It's like, no, it's a men's issue as well, that once they just had to do the career and now they have to do the career and the family. So we're all trying to do perhaps a lot more. And maybe our expectations are raised and we all put that self-care piece last.
Oh, definitely. But I think the benefit women have, again, we're generalizing a lot, but the benefit a lot of females have is you guys are much better at juggling friendships and maintaining that social connection. Mm. Women catch up for a 20-minute coffee. and, you know, that's a catch up.
Yeah.
Or for me, if I called up a mate and said, hey, let's do coffee, they'd say, what for? I said, well, just
why? Think
and they might go, oh, okay. It's not as natural. It's not as organic. Men need to be doing things, which often takes longer, which is why they neglect it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Good point. Yeah, so it should be a game goal for I don't really want to advocate catching up at the pub because I'm sure that leads to some other issues as well.
Camping or watching the footy or something along those lines, doing something. There has to be some doing involved.
Yeah, and I wonder if that is, you know, I do remember hearing, in fact, I've had a couple of people reflect to me again in workplaces when it's been conversations about how things are going and noticing that someone isn't perhaps themselves. And I've had a couple of men say to me, oh, I have those conversations where we're in the car going somewhere. You know, so if you've got to go out and travel to a work site or something, that's when I have the conversation because we're side by side. You don't have to make eye contact. It's just easier to allow that conversation to kind of come up. It's less confronting somehow. So the environment maybe plays a part.
Yeah. No, that's exactly what I suggest parents do when they're trying to talk to their teenager. Just on the drive to soccer, on the drive to the sleepover, just have a chat.
Yeah. So the doing stuff, and I do remember maybe that was something that I read in Steve Bidoff's book, but doing stuff with, even if it's, you know, getting your son to help with the washing up, the activity is important, having an activity rather than just having a conversation. And you're right, women do catch up for coffee. We catch up just to talk. We just talk because that's what we do. Or maybe it's because that's what's been modelled for us. But I can see that if you need to then, you know, for men, if it is around some kind of activity, then that doesn't happen as easily or as organically in the context of a really busy life.
No, it's a lot harder to arrange, isn't it?
But it's important.
Oh, crucial.
Anything else that you'd advise for men or for the partners of men, the people with men in their families, if you want to do something to help improve well-being and seek help where required, any other tips or strategies?
I think I gave a talk recently at a Father's Day breakfast and they asked me to talk about, it was for daughters and dads, and they said, can you talk about how daughters can support fathers? And I thought they had it the other way around, but no, they said, how can young daughters support their fathers? And the one thing I talked a lot about, and I might have already gone over this, but it is giving dad permission and encouraging dad to have a life outside of work and family. Because as you touched on before, if that is all dad's life is, then his identity consists of work and home. I'm the accountant, I'm the, you know, the builder, and I'm dad. When one of those falls over, then that's when things get serious because there's no other outlets. There's no other outlets whatsoever. But if dad also catches up with friends, he, you know, plays veterans footy once a week and, you know, he might play golf once every few months, he's got something else. And I don't, the importance of that can be understated at all.
Yeah, I spoke to Dee Anderson recently on the podcast and we were talking about athletes and well-being, and she said she uses, and it's funny because I've used this a couple of times now with other people, uses the analogy of the chair and how the chair needs to have four stable legs that really give you that well-roundedness. And those four legs could be lots of different things for different people, but using it in that context that you were just describing there, you know, for men, they, you know, work might be a leg, family might be another leg, but sport could be a third and some other hobby could be the fourth. And as soon as you take one of those away, that chair just becomes very unstable.
Yeah. I heard that episode. I love that analogy. It's so true.
It's good, isn't it? I know I've used it a couple of times too. That's what I love about this podcast is we all get to learn stuff and kind of spread the benefits around. And so, Carl, resources, books, other things. We've mentioned Steve Bidoff's books and I will put those in the show notes. Are there other sources of information for anyone, whether they are young men themselves, older men, whether they are the partners or daughters or mothers of men? Where else can people look for information?
I know we've talked about Steve, but I have to talk about one of his other books.
Sure.
That I recommend to everybody in the men's space or if you've got a husband or somebody worried about his male. It's a recent book in the last few years called The New Manhood. And I think he released it 10 years ago, but he's recently released a new edition, and it's available for free actually on podcast format as well. You can buy the hard copy, but he's released it for free. Each track is a different chapter, and basically it talks about the history of boys and men, the importance of fatherhood, how we really failed boys post-industrial revolution, all that sort of stuff. But also for adult men, the importance of having some form of a relationship with your dad, and if you can't, what that means, and all of those sort of things. So that's number one, definite must read. Yep. The other one we're recommending a lot of clients lately, not specific to men at all, is it's called Lost Connections. You might have heard of it by Johan Hari. So he was the chap, some people might have seen the really famous addictions TED Talk.
Yes, yes, have seen that.
So this is the same guy. He's a British author, and basically he went around the world for, I think, 2 or 3 years interviewing all the leading experts and researchers in psychology, psychiatry, and basically narrowed it down to a book and talks about, I think, the 9 or 10 main causes of depression and anxiety. So whether you know somebody with depression and anxiety, you've experienced it yourself, you're a bit unsure, I guarantee anybody who reads it will resonate with it. It's fantastic.
Okay, so that's called Lost Connections, and I'll put a link to that. I'll put a link to that TED Talk too, because I think that's a really interesting TED Talk for anybody who hasn't seen it. And where can people find you, Carl?
So you can check out blokepsychology.com.au. Probably if you're not in Melbourne, better off to check our Facebook, Bloke Psychology. We're always posting a lot of, whether it's our own blogs or different initiatives from around Australia, around the world, advocating the men's mental health space and well-being, and that's a nice little interactive community that we're developing there.
Beautiful. And I did notice that you had posted something about the comedian Dave Hughes.
Yes.
I think in the last week or so. So a news article about him and talking again about his experience, particularly as a young man and getting into drinking and other things, and then what it took for him to realize. And I think it was actually, he said, a conversation with his mum.
Yeah.
Got him to the point of realizing that he had to do something to change the kind of trajectory that he was on and to be the kind of man that he wanted to be.
Mm. And look at him now.
Yeah. Carl, thank you very much for everything today. I've really enjoyed it, both as a fellow psychologist, but also as a parent. You've certainly given me some things to think about as I approach the parenting of, well, my eldest son's just turned 10, so our adolescent years are not far away. So how I might approach that to do the best by them, and maybe by us as a family too, also as a partner. So I've walked away with lots of tips and strategies, and I'm going to check out some of the resources that you've mentioned. Thank you.
No, thank you, Ellen. It's been an absolute pleasure. First podcast I've appeared on, so got that under my belt. So I really appreciate it. It's a pleasure to be on the show.
Lovely. And first of many, I hope. I spread the word. So you've got plenty of great stuff to share with people, because I think it is, you know, this is an under-discussed space. I get the sense that that's changing, and we're getting more mental health resources that are specifically targeted at men, but it's really early days. So I think it's a fabulous niche for you to be in, and you're obviously making a difference to people, which is just wonderful.
Oh, thanks, Ellen. Really appreciate it.
I hope you, if like me, you are the parent of boys, you've taken away some tips from Carl on how to help your young man to thrive and flourish. And if you're a bloke listening to this, I hope that what Carl had to say has resonated with you, and that you too have taken away some tips on thriving, flourishing, and taking care of your well-being, and perhaps helping your mates to do the same. Certainly do encourage them to seek some assistance and support if you're concerned that they're not travelling well, and a GP is a great place to start. Thank you for joining this conversation. Jay and I have put the links to the books and the TED Talk that Carl mentioned, as well as a downloadable summary of Carl's tips and his contact details, in the show notes for this episode. As always, you can find them at potential.com.au/podcast. And if you enjoyed today's episode, please let us know. You can rate and review the podcast on iTunes, as that's the best way to spread the word about all of our guests and the work that we do in promoting wellbeing. You can also chat to me via email, ellenjackson@potential.com.au, and on all of the socials, just search for Potential Psychology. Next week's episode, we'll be turning our attention to work, and in particular, workplace well-being and the role that leaders play in creating happy, thriving workplaces. My guest, Karen Gillespie, and I will be talking in particular about a nifty tool for helping leaders to uncover the strengths and challenges relating to their own well-being. Because we know, as Simon Sinek says, that the leader sets the tone. Here's Karen to tell us a little more.
We talk about well-being, particularly for leaders, as being this kind of careful balancing act between the challenges or demands that you're experiencing or that are coming at you at any one time, both in work and outside of work. It's a holistic approach. And so it's this careful balancing act between the demands or challenges coming at you and the resources that you have available to you to meet those challenges and demands. And the closer those two things are in equilibrium, then, you know, the better your well-being is going to be. And those resources can be your physical health and well-being. You know, did you get a good sleep last night? The emotional strength that you have, the relationships and the support you have around you, the resources that the organization helps you with as well.
I'm very much looking forward to bringing that to you, as well-being at work is one of my pet topics. But in the meantime, have a fabulous week, and I'll see you next time.